Well, my name is Ray O'Keefe, and I'm an alcoholic. The reading just now was talking about something being cunning and baffling and powerful, and it also said there was one who had all power. And power is a word that we use a great deal in Alcoholics Anonymous. We start the first step by saying we're powerless. And alcoholism, I found out, is a very powerful disease. It's so powerful, alcoholism. It kills people who don't have it. That's a very powerful disease. It actually kills people who don't have the disease. I had an older brother. He was 4 years older than I was, my brother Billy. And he was acting very badly all his life, and I had come into AA, and I talked to my older brother, and he assured me he was not alcoholic. And he died. And on his death certificate, they put down cause of death, alcoholism. Very powerful disease. It killed my brother, and he didn't even have it. Difficult. Difficult disease. And it almost got me, too, and I don't think I would have lasted much longer. I sometimes say, it's a little dramatic, I suppose, that if I had come here one day later, it might have been too late. And if I had come here one day earlier, I might not have stayed. Because there is something very mysterious, I think, about when someone reaches this thing we call the bottom. When, why my last drink was my last drink, I really have no answer. That day wasn't so different from many other days that I had experienced. In fact, I had been in worse shape than I was that day. I had been in worse shape physically and emotionally, in worse shape financially. But that just seemed to be the day that that I stopped drinking. And I don't know, I had to sort of experience the ABCs. I had to understand that I was alcoholic and could not manage my own life, that no human power could relieve my alcoholism, but that God could and would if he was sought. And that required me, of course, to come to an understanding of God, or to come to terms with God as I understood him. And I really was not interested in a God who came down from the mountain, or a God who came down from the cross, or a God who came out from a cave in a pillar of fire and smoke or anything like that. I wasn't interested in that. But I sure was interested in having a power manage my life, a God of my understanding, our Father, your Father, my Father. A God who cared so much for someone like me, who really didn't have very much that anybody could care about. A God who cared so much about some drunk like me that he came into the gutter in which I found myself on that day and brought me here and showed me a way out, a solution to this problem that I had. I was very interested in something, some power greater than my own that could do that for me. It was a very practical thing. And I stopped drinking. And I haven't had a drink now for a while. And I've been coming to these meetings. And somewhere along the line, after I had taken care of the emergency aspects of my problem with alcoholism, after I had stopped drinking, which took care of the physical problem, and after I came to believe that I could be restored to sanity, which did something for me mentally, restored some of my mental capacities. I could do a crossword puzzle, that kind of stuff. I knew my name. I could write it down. So I began to recover slowly mentally. And then I came to this understanding of our Father. And I began a spiritual recovery and tried to follow these guidelines. But then because I had a sponsor, which was the best thing that ever happened to me, I talked to him today. We keep in touch. Because I had that man who had been here, who had been through the path that we follow. He told me there was something else the matter. It was not just the drinking. He said, there's something else the matter. There's something else in your life. There are defects in your character. That was not good news. That was not good news. I thought I was a nice guy that drank too much. But he told me nice guys who drink too much don't come to Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't need any nice guys here who drink too much. Nice guys who drink too much should drink. Nice guys who drink too much should stay home and drink. They should get drunk 4 or 5 times a year. Put the lampshade on their head, put the party hat on. Talk dirty, become a pain in the ass. Everybody understands. He's having a good time. He's a nice guy. He just drinks too much. But we don't get that here. We get no good, rotten, low-life sons of bitches that get thrown through this door, and this is the last stop. This is where they stop. If they don't stay here. Used to have an Anglican priest in New York used to say you can sober up a bum, but if the bum don't change, he won't be sober very long. And that was me. I had to find out what else was the matter. What else was the matter? There was a lot the matter with me. And I had to stay here with you to find out what was wrong with me. And I had to find out that my defects of character, my shortcomings, were the primary cause of my alcoholism and resulted in my defective relationships with other people. And in my case, the primary symptom of my character defects was not only the drinking that I did, but the isolation that I put myself into. I'm a fairly gregarious fellow. I get along. I'm a great barroom companion. You want to stand up at a bar and, you know, have a few and tell some stories, that kind of stuff, I'm with you. And I like to meet people. I like new people, and I like old people. I like all kinds of people. I'm halfway gregarious anyhow. If I weren't such a snob, I'd be all the way gregarious. But that wasn't true at the end of my life. I was isolated at the end of my drinking life. I was all alone. I was all by myself. There was nobody I could talk to. Who are you going to talk to? I couldn't tell anybody how I lived. I lived 3 different lives. I couldn't tell the guys in the bar. I was terrified all the time. I couldn't tell the people at the law school that I threw up every morning and went to bed every night. They don't like that in law schools. And I couldn't communicate with my family, and so I was alone, and it ended up with me and a bottle of vodka. And of course, the more I drank, the more isolated I became, and the more isolated I became, the more I drank. And when I crawled back in here, finally, in November of 1965, I don't think there were 3 people in this world I could have called my friend. I didn't have any friends. I had some, but they were gone. And I didn't have a good job. I had one that was gone. And everything that was of value to me had gone. I don't know where it went. It just went. And I thought I was in some kind of a time warp. I thought I was where I had been like 15 years before that. I thought everything was all right. But it was just, nothing was, life on the edge, and very gray. And every day is very much like another, so. I did steps 4 and 5. And I got some idea what I was about. I understood my defects of character. He pointed them out to me. Any doubt I had about them, he was very happy to point out my shortcomings to me. He sort of had a good time watching my ego collapse all around him. That was good for me. It was a good experience. And the hardest part about it was not doing it. Doing it when after I was finished. Like most of our steps, once you do them, once they're finished, then you say, well, what the hell was the fuss all about? That was pretty good. That was not so bad. But a lot of people stop doing it. They want to do 4. They start talking code. They start rationalizing. What they're really telling you is that they want to drink. They're working on their inventory. Working on that, you know, or they're working on their third inventory, which is almost as bad as working on it on their first inventory. But I had to do those things. I wasn't willing, and I wasn't happy about it. But I did want to get well, and I did want to stay here, and I was afraid to go back there. I just was afraid to drink. Of course, I knew it would get me. It got everybody else in my family. I knew it would get me, and I didn't really... I don't want to go now, but I sure didn't want to go then, and I didn't want to go that way. And I finally got an understanding of myself, and that's what 4 and 5 is for. Our steps are in groups. The first three are the emergency room, where we take care of the immediate problem of drinking. And 4 and 5 give you a relationship with yourself. 6 and 7 give you a relationship with God. And I never had that. I didn't have a relationship with God. How could I have a relationship with God? I didn't have time for that. I wasn't interested in it. But I got one in 6 and 7. I became entirely ready. I did the work in the garden, and I hoped and I knew that God would grow some kind of a flower. And then I asked him. I developed a relationship with our Father, with your Father, my Father. And I asked him, please, you know, help me do this thing. Show me the way to do it. Take it all. Take the good, take the bad, take whatever you want. I indicated to him I at least was willing to do this. I think he got the notion that I was willing. And then in time I was ready, and then I asked him, and he began to do things for me. It was time then to develop a relationship with the people around me, and that's what steps 8 and 9 are for. And after all, what is there? I mean, what is there in the human condition? We have ourselves. We have our relationship with ourselves, our relationship with God, and the people around us. That's all there is. You don't have a relationship with chairs or tables. Some of us fall in love with our automobiles, but they don't last. Mine don't. So it's a permanent thing. I had to write a list. I didn't want to do that either. Everybody, he said. People who are dead, everybody. People who moved away, everybody. All. Make a list of all persons that you've harmed. Guys who did it to me more than I did it to them, everybody, he said. Her? Everybody, he said. Them? Everybody. Man had no mercy. I had to do 2 lists. He didn't take the first one. The book tells us that we need prudence and judgment. 2 things I didn't have any of. I had no prudence, I had no judgment. But I did come up with this list. And that's all he asked me to do. I didn't have to go into any psychological roop-de-doop about it. Just the names, he said. I want to list the names. And then he said, if you want to, you don't have to, but if you want to, just put next to them what you think you can do for them. So I came up with a list. And I was ready to make amends. I was willing to say I was sorry. I told you about my friend Stuart. He's my friend now. And I told you about the book I never wrote and the money that Stuart gave me. And I owed Stuart money. I'm not sure how much it was, but it was a lot of money. It was more money than I had when I wrote the list. I know that. And he said, what are you going to do about Stuart? You owe him this money. I said, I'm going to tell him I'm sorry. He said, that's just what he needs. Just what he needs. So let me tell you what happened with Stuart. About a little while later, whenever it was, I ran into a case, I got a case, involving a drug, which had a wonderful side effect. It was a very effective drug, great antibiotic. Unfortunately, it killed people. It had an unfortunate side effect. It destroyed the spleen, but it killed any infection you might have, but it also took your spleen right out of it. Caused a condition called aplastic anemia and killed you. And this had killed someone I knew's son, and he brought the case to me, and I was sober now. And it's a valuable case for a lawyer to have. It was a good case. So I took it, and I worked it up, and when came time to really get it moving, I took it down to Stewart. And I said, take this case and process it and take it to court and get the money. And when you get the money, lawyers, as you know, share money. Bring the money around and I'll pay you back the money I owe you. It was my vehicle to give him back his money. And in due time, he settled that case and he got the dough. And I went down on a Wednesday. You have to sign all these papers, and you have to make an accounting of where the money's going and all of that, and you have to show everybody that you have a piece of it, and we have all these rules. So I signed and signed and signed. And when I left, I said to him, now don't forget, you have now complete control over the money. When you get it, just take mine off the top, and if there's anything left, and I knew there was going to be some left, just send it to me. Thank you. And I left. And we were friends, and we got along. Following Saturday, I was sitting home with a fellow named Bob from our group, and the mail came, and there was a letter from Stewart. And I said, oh, look at this. I said, Bob, this is a check. I'll buy you lunch today. And I opened it up, and there was a check for the full amount. And a letter from Stewart saying, well, a long time has gone by since we had that book deal, and you seem to be doing very well. And we know you're in that program. And we know you're doing something for the lawyers who have this problem. So my partners and I thought that we'd just send you the whole amount. And that's when I knew this goddamn step worked. Geez, I went running around the library, look at this, you know. And it worked. Now, not every time I went out to make amends, I wasn't that good. If that was going on, I'd still be making amends. I'd spend 15 years, I'd do one a day if it was going to produce a result like that. Well, that's what happened with Stewart. And I got to see him on a regular basis and his partners. And the last case I had before I came down, the last case I had before I stopped being an active lawyer, was with one of his partners. And we reminisced about it all, and we got along fine. And that's only because my sponsor made me make direct amends. I would have preferred to make indirect amends. You know? How about an anonymous letter? Isn't that nice? Or how about a contribution to your favorite charity? Not a big one, just a contribution to it. The Catholics have a wonderful thing. They call it the poor box. And every Catholic church has this box. It's for the poor. You put in some money when you feel like it. It's also a great place to get money if you're broke. And I got to some of these other amends. He said, what are you going to do about the money you owe this guy? I said, how about the pool box? You know, you get a discount there. You got a confession, tell a priest you stole 50. He said, well, put 5 in the pool box. Get a little discount. No, he said, you got to make direct amends. He said, amends really means, and I believe it, that get the situation back where it was before you screwed it up. And actually, now that I have the experience with it and I'm finished with my amends, the financial part was, for me, the easiest part. Because that's cut and dried and the easiest thing in the world. My problem was I didn't recognize harm to be anything other than physical or financial harm. I didn't recognize emotional or spiritual harm. I didn't know that my big mouth had I'd hurt people and injured people. I thought they should be tough enough to take it when I was giving it to them. I thought people should lie still while I screwed them, you know? And not cause a fuss just because I was doing running a number by them. I mean, what the hell are they getting excited about? And I had to learn different values about that. He told me that the idea was to be of maximum service to God and the people around me. He told me I could not do that. I could not be of any service to anybody if I was hiding from people. And I was hiding from people because I owed them an amends. I was always hiding. It was very difficult. I worked primarily in this one building, courthouse. And I was there practically every day. And the same group of people were there every day. The only people that changed were the four clients. The lawyers were always the same. The judges were all the same. And I was forever hopping into stalls and bathrooms because I didn't want to see. Here he comes. I'd run in the John and jump into a stall. You know, you make an appointment with me. Sure, go to a men's room, go to the third stall, and knock three times, and maybe he'll let you in. And it was difficult to practice law that way, you know. All the judges say, where's O'Keefe? He's in the bathroom, you know, hiding. I had to come out of there. I couldn't do it. And I couldn't get out of there until I got straight with all these people. And not all of them were money. A lot of them were just because I had a big mouth. And somehow it seemed to me that if I'd said something nice about you, it would somehow detract from me. So I rarely had anything good to say about anybody. And he made me put all that down, and I had to go around and do it. And I had to do it face to face. I had to go see these people. And sometimes I sure didn't want to. What I used to do, I sort of had a little schedule that I would try to see this person or that person. I used to take a train to work. It took about 40 minutes to get into Grand Central. If I knew I was going to see somebody that day about an amends, boy, all the way down, I'd be doing the third step prayer, so that I would have the strength and the courage to go. And it's good because it reminded me of the wreckage I had caused. I was very much like the man in the book that they talk about in the ninth step, who, after the tornado has leveled the whole thing, comes up out of the cellar and says to his wife, isn't it nice the wind stopped blowing? And that was me. What the hell? I wasn't drinking, right? I didn't drink anymore. What the hell's everybody? I was willing to let bygones be bygones. What's everybody getting excited about? I don't drink anymore. They should build a little statue of me up at the station. But I had my sponsor. I think the most important thing about the ninth step is to have your sponsor guide you through it. He said it's time for you to become a father to your children. I had seven children. And I didn't know anything about being a father. And these were all strangers to me. They were good friends of my wife's. They got along fine. I just used to drop in from time to time and say no, you know. Get out of here. No. And he said, time for you to do that. Well, I had to get that situation. The book says we can scarcely make amends to our family in a lifetime. And I had to somehow become a father to these kids. I had to be there and treat them in a civilized way. I think I really ended up treating them like pigeons. Somebody said that he treats all his kids like pigeons. I just give him the mushroom treatment. You know the mushroom treatment? It's like how you grow mushrooms. You keep them in the dark and give them a lot of shit. But I had to end up being a father. I went to an awful lot of Little League games. Went to an awful lot of Little League games. Sat and watched a lot of 23, 21 games. Sat with the mothers. That's worse than watching a game. Sitting with the mothers. Went to a lot of father and son stuff, that kind of stuff. A lot of high school games. And I ended up with, I guess, I'm certainly not the world's greatest father, but I get along good with most of them, I think. I talked to two of them today. And we get along pretty well. I had to be a friend to my friends. And I didn't know how to be a friend to my friends. My idea of people was that they were disposable. You know, you use them. You get what you can, and then you throw them away and get some more. And if I met somebody, my first thought was, well, you know, how can I get at this guy? You know, what kind of an angle can I use? How can this guy help me? Can he help me in business, or can he help me socially, or help me some other way politically? I all use people all the time. I had to stop doing that. And of course, this program helps a great deal with that because I found myself available in this program. And I learned from sponsoring other people to take an interest in other people's lives. And to understand that other people had certain rights and I had responsibilities to make sure I didn't interfere with other people's lives. I had to face up to all of this stuff, that I had to be a friend to my friends. Maybe that's easy for people who are not alcoholic, but when you are as self-centered and selfish as I am, it's tough to be a friend to your friends. To be there when some guy needs a little hand, needs a little help. I had to face up to my responsibilities. I had to face up to the fact that if I worked for somebody or if I was a partner with somebody in a law firm, I had to show up for work. If I'm supposed to work, I work. I suppose other people might consider that sort of self-evident, that if you're on a payroll, you should show up for work. Hadn't occurred to me. My job, the job I was fired from, is the same job I have now, same kind of a job. And I work now, I have a job, my job is full-time. I work 6 hours a week, 26 weeks a year. I was fired from that kind of a job for not showing up. Can you imagine? I finished today. I don't have to work again on Tuesday. I worked an hour. I worked from 9 to 10 this morning. Lying to children. Which is what I do. But I had to show up. I had to show up for work. And I had to do what I was supposed to do. The only thing I ever did was get adjournments. I could have written a book on continuances. O'Keefe on adjournments. I had to show up and I had to stop lying to people. And I had to understand that it wasn't them. It wasn't them. It wasn't they. They didn't do it to me. They didn't do anything to me. I did it. I did it to myself. It wasn't them. It wasn't they. It wasn't her. It was me. It wasn't my mother. It wasn't my father. I have to go running around to adult children of alcoholics and somehow make myself out to be a victim. I did it. Nobody did it to me. Nobody ever put a gun in my head and said, drink this or I'll kill you. I tell you, the only time I ever said no to a drink, I completely misunderstood the question. It was not them. It was not them. It was me. And I wasn't going through this immense process for them. One guy didn't like what I had to say. He told me. He told me you were never any good and I don't believe you now. Get out of here. I said, wait a minute, I'm not finished. He said, yes, you are. Get out of here. I said to my sponsor, he don't like what I told him. He didn't take what I said. Sponsor said, it's not for him, stupid. It's for you. Now let him worry about it. I said, you're finished with him. You did everything you could. We don't make the amends for those other people. God knows we've done enough for them. He also told me that making amends is not just trying to renegotiate an old relationship. I see that sometimes with people I sponsor, especially, you know, marriage or girlfriends or something. I think I'll call up Mildred and make an amends to her. Say, so why in the world would you do that? You know, Mildred hasn't, you haven't seen Mildred in a long time, and she's very happy doing what she's doing. As a matter of fact, Mildred is married and living somewhere. Yeah, but I think I better go see Mildred. You know. Gonna renegotiate an old relationship. You know? God might be very severe in cases like that. So I had to learn not to do that. I had to learn that. I really, the whole program is for me, and this going around for other people and doing what I could for them really had its benefits for me, and I had to understand that I was the one that caused this problem. I was the one that had screwed it up. These other people, my friends, were prepared to be my friends. My children wanted me to be their father. I was what they got. My partners wanted me to be a partner. And my dean wanted me to be a professor. They all wanted me to be these things. It was me that managed to screw it up. Nobody did this to me. I'm not a victim. I suffer from a disease. I don't know where I got it. I'm really not interested where I got it. But it wasn't Mommy. It wasn't Daddy who did it to me. I'm an adult child of an alcoholic. And all my children are adult child of alcoholics. And 6 of my children are members of AA. But I didn't do it to them. They did it. And they came into AA. All on their own. I didn't send them to AA. They came here. I'm always, when I think of this, I always think of the great cartoon. You remember Pogo? Pogo the alligator lived right over there in the west in the Everglades. And he was sitting on the log one day with Albert, his good and dear friend, Albert. And Pogo said to Albert, I have met the enemy, and it is us. And I was it. I used to say, I'm my own worst enemy. And she said, not while I'm alive. And after a while, I had good experiences, I told you, with these nice steps. I really wanted to do them. I really wanted to do them. Dr. Bob came into this program doing the ninth step. If you read our book, on the day that he stopped drinking, he got back home late that night. Bill asked him where he'd been. He said he'd been driving around Akron, Ohio in his old Buick, mending fences, making amends, trying to set things straight. He had visited a number of people his very first day and told them that he had this problem, that he had met this man from New York and he thought there was help. And he was going to see what he could do to get the situation back to where it should be. I don't think we need wait for this. I think we should do it all as soon as we can, very fast. And the benefits of doing this are just incredible. I have some more of these cards. Some people told me they didn't get any, so I brought some more. I'll leave them up here. Third step prayer, seventh step prayer, serenity prayer, and the promises. And this is what we get at the ninth step. And I know you've heard these many times, but I really like to listen to them. It says, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door upon it. We will... I can't read it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience will benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us all of the things we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. You know, when I was drinking and in the last throes of alcoholism, not one of those promises would have had any interest for me. I was not interested in serenity or knowing peace. And I had long since despaired of being happy. And I knew that my experience could not benefit anybody. I wanted to bury the past. I was ashamed of my past. I wouldn't talk about my past. I couldn't tell anybody what I had done or where I had been. Just couldn't do it. And then I came here, I found out my past is an asset. But those were not wasted years. I didn't lose all those years. I've been able to use every one of those experiences here in Alcoholics Anonymous. If someone new comes here and they're afraid and they're in a state of terror, I know how to talk to them. I know what that's like. If they come here and they're ashamed because they've been fired from a job, welcome to the club. Or they've done something particularly reprehensible, I know about that. It's an amazing thing. And you begin, I think, at this step. The book tells us that at this step, we are restored to sanity. This is the step where we really have experienced a great deal of our recovery. And we're able to lose, I was able to lose some of that selfishness, not all of it. I wish I had. I wish I was not self-centered. I am self-centered. I wish I were not. I'm not anything as self-centered as once I was. But I'm a long way from where I'd like to be. But it gets a little better. Gets a little better. And working with the new people and being at these kind of meetings and sharing and going around and meeting everybody, you lose some. I lost some of that self-centeredness. I sure found out I was not the only drunk in the world. I thought I was. Nobody else had my problems. I lost that altogether when I got here. In fact, I've met very few people whose problems I would prefer rather than my own. I'm a little comfortable with my own little problems. Some people come in here with much bigger problems than I ever had. And I've learned to trust my judgment. I don't know how intuitive I am, but I've learned to trust my judgment. I've learned that there are principles in this program, and that if I follow them, it isn't so often that I make a mistake of the kind I used to make. It isn't so often I make a mistake in dealing with other people, because now I don't have to lie to them all the time. And if you don't lie to people, you tell them what's going on, you tell them the truth as you understand it, you usually can work a deal. And you develop, I've developed, and you get a certain reputation for it. The people in my business know now that if I tell them I will do something, I'll do it. Or I'll try to do it. If it can be done, I'll do it. That was not so when I was drinking. And in my business, reputation is a great thing. I got a phone call today from New York, from the school that fired me. Same school that invited me back last spring to give my daughter her degree. Same school that rehired me after I've been sober a long time. And they call me today, and they ask me to serve as an honorary trustee of a new foundation that they're starting, and to come up there in December and come to a lunch they're giving. And they read me off a list of the names of the people that are going to serve on this thing. Very credible bunch. Very credible bunch. A couple of ex-governors and senators. And your trusted servant. I don't know how. You know how that happens? Nobody told me about that when I started to make amends. I just thought I was trying to get things even. I thought I was just trying to sort of take the zig out of my zag so I wouldn't be zigging and zagging around that courthouse or hiding behind trees or parked automobiles in the little town where I lived, you know. Or not being able to answer the phone or open the mail, that kind of stuff. I thought I was just going to do that. How did I know? That you get a little better and a little better, and then about 20 years go by and become simply wonderful. Nobody told me about that. And now I can really tell you that each one of these promises has come into my life. Every single one of them. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. But I had to work for them. I had to make my amends. I had to do what I was told. I had to follow the instructions of my sponsor. I had to accept responsibility for what I had done. I couldn't rationalize anymore. It was always them. It was always they. It was never my fault. I didn't do it. I sound like my kids, you know. Who left the back in the driveway? I didn't do it. I did it.
It was me. I had to do it.
And, of course, one of the greatest benefits of all is not all is the honor and the glory and all that stuff that I get. But I'm not isolated anymore. I am not isolated anymore. I am part of the first word of this program. I'm part of the we. I belong here. I'm a member here. I'm supposed to be here, and I'm comfortable here, and I'm happy here. So if you're at this stage and you've made your list, see your sponsor. Make the recommends to all the people you have harmed. Except when to do so would injure them or others. That's not an out. That doesn't get you out. That just requires you a little prudence and go talk to your sponsor before you go running around and renegotiating with Mildred. You understand? And if you can do all of those things, then you've done the ninth step. Thank you.